Did William Shakespeare actually invent the bedroom?
What does it mean to be embroiled in a garboil?
And could the bard really have written all of those plays?
We'll hobnob and swagger through coinages, insults, and idioms found in Dear William's works on this episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Safaris, author of the etymology books Once Upon a Word and Words from Hell and soon to be Useless Etymology. Check it out.
Ooh.
And today we are joined by a little Shakespeare, my little friend here, because we are our podcast today is dedicated to an act of bardolatry. Sorry, for our podcast listeners, I have an itty bitty Shakespeare with me on camera.
Really itty bitty, small enough to fit in her top pocket.
Yeah, he's going to hang out here for the duration of the episode, unless he decides to come out later.
And funnily enough, I also have a prop that isn't too friendly to our podcast listeners, but is also miniaturized. Check this thing out. I have to be very careful with it. Just hold on.
Ooh, no idea what we're about to see. This is going to be a total surprise.
So I should just say, people watching will notice I'm in a different setting. I'm actually back in England. I'm at my parents' house, and they have in their possession this thing here, which is a complete works of Shakespeare.
It's so tiny.
Look at how tiny.
Oh, it's so wee. They're so tiny. Which one is that?
Oh, that's actually his tiny, tiny sonnets.
Oh my goodness. The words must be very hard to read.
Let me try and open one. So this is made in like 1904. So, you know, it's not old, but it's pretty old. You've got to be careful with it. But tiny, tiny, complete works of Shakespeare in a little cube.
And we're doing this with our miniaturized Shakespeare items on his birthday, which is April 23rd. It's also his death day. He died on his birthday in 1616 after his birthday in 1564.
And so far as I'm concerned, that is the only significant thing about this day, Jess.
I am a little selfish in asking to have released this episode on his birthday because it is also my birthday. So many, many fun reasons to celebrate. But primarily we're here for the bard.
Yeah, but happy birthday, Jess.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so the bard, born in 1564, died in 1616 on the same date. And actually, if you look in the Oxford English Dictionary and you look for citations by him, you'll see a lot of them are just given as 1616, which makes it seem like he was awfully prolific in the final year of his life. He wasn't. It's just when they're not totally sure, they tend to put that as the date because it's the last possible point at which he could have used the words. And we're going to talk about the many, many words that he is said to have coined in his 40 odd plays. I say 40 odd because in the first folio, which is a collection of his works that's compiled by a couple of friends of his, there are not a single one existent copies of plays by his own hand. We're entirely working off what's been collected by his friends, basically, from, you know, actors' copies, etc., etc. 36 in the first folio, 39 if you include his collaborations, and then there are two lost plays, one of which is Love's Labour's One, the counterpart to Love's Labour's Lost, but might also have just been the original title for As You Like It. Mm. And then there's another collaborative one called Cardenio, which he wrote with a guy called John Fletcher. So that takes you up to 41. So he wrote about 40 plays, another 154 sonnets and a few other poems. So, I mean, this man he's prolific.
Wildly prolific and wildly popular because these plays were fun for everyone. They were taken to the public eye. They were accessible. They were multicultural as well. So there's so much to love here. And it's reflected in the fact that he still has such a strong influence on the way we speak and write and tell stories today.
Yeah. And there are questions over whether one person could write all of this brilliance, which we'll get into those questions later. I'd be interested to know if we have the same opinion on them, Jess. But he's generally accredited with giving us 1,700 words. That's like the number that will come up wherever you look now. And does that seem realistic?
a lot of them are alterations or remixes of pre-existing words. He added prefixes and suffixes, changed parts of speech, verbed nouns and vice versa, and then combined words all over the place sometimes to properly iamb that pentameter or get the rhyme scheme right. This is still an act of creativity. I would argue that's still good. Granted, sometimes that number includes words for which we have found earlier references since that number was claimed, or it'll be a new usage of an old word. His works contain the first known appearance of like circumstantial and fashionable in the way that we use them now, but fashionable already existed as a word before, and then circumstance already existed. They meant different things and were used in different ways. I certainly think that he deserves credit for usage of them, but having coined them is a matter of debate for many of the words.
I think he probably was the first, certainly, to write down.
Yes.
And probably did create an awful lot of words, and maybe as many as 1,700, because I think he's many more than 1,700 are overall attributed to him. And then if you sort of take into account wastage from the number that he really didn't coin, where there are earlier usages of it, or where his usage of it doesn't actually match up with how we use the word. A good one is he's often accredited with coining the word bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
And he does use the word bedroom, but he uses it in a new way. He uses it in A Midsummer Night's Dream to mean space in your bed. So bedroom.
Then by your side, no bedroom me deny, for lying so Hermia, I do not lie.
Yeah, that's Lysander and Hermia. And the idea is that Lysander is trying to basically cuddle up to Hermia in the forest.
That play is so horny.
He's being a bit of a creep, right? Overall. So did he coin our word bedroom? No, he probably didn't. But there are people using the word bedroom who are his contemporaries in a way that we use it now to mean a room that has your bed in it. I mean, I found a quote from 1600. So that is in his lifetime. That's from a French translation. So a text that's been translated into English from French, and it has the word bedroom in it, meaning a room with a bed in it. Now, if you're doing a translation, you don't invent words. That is not helpful. You call upon the existing word hoard, the words that people are using, because the whole point is to help people understand. So that rather suggests that the word had currency by that point anyway.
The distinction and the reason sometimes it is fully attributed to Shakespeare is because the more common word for a bedroom at the time was bedchamber. But of course, that doesn't fit the rhyme scheme.
Yeah, exactly. Like another good one where it seems like he may have just been trying to get the iambic pentameter right is he is also credited with, and it would appear he did, use the word dawn rather than dawning, which it was called, you know, the rise of the sun was called the dawning rather than dawn, but he knocked off that syllable in a way that probably helped him out.
That happens a lot. He backformed many words in our first instances, as far as we know, like negotiate from negotiation, metamorphose from metamorphosis, and then the other way around too. Like assassination is first found in his works, but assassin is older, and assassinate probably existed contemporaneously.
Groveling is a good one. He coins the word grovel, so that doesn't exist before, based around sort of the mistaken understanding of what the ing means at the end. So the ling at the end of groveling is a slightly obscure sort of dialectic way of creating an adverb. So groveling was used as an adverb to mean doing something face down. I found a quote from 1542. To sleep groveling upon the stomach and belly is not good, right? So you do something groveling, you do something face down. And Shakespeare is the first to knock the ing off the end of that and call, you know, going face down to grovel itself.
Prostrating yourself, so to speak. We also get like updated versions of Middle English words that weren't otherwise in popular usage. Like the word hint is often attributed to Shakespeare and it appears in Othello. It was my hint to speak, such was the process. He says it twice in that line actually, but he's adapting the Middle English noun hent and its corresponding verb hinten, which the verb meant to tell or inform, or literally to seize upon something. So a hint is something physically to be seized, a small bit of information that you can grasp, so to speak, in conversation.
Oh, okay. So he uses hint in The Tempest as well. A hint of woe is common, which I'd interpreted as, you know, a verb being turned into a noun, which I guess it kind of is.
A weird one
like that. You know, it's an old word that he's somehow accredited with, you know, creating a version of that must have occurred before. And he's accredited with the word kissing, despite the fact that kusan, C-Y-S-S-A-N, is an old English verb meaning, you know, to kiss. I'm pretty sure Shakespeare is using it in a very specific way, you know, because to kiss can just mean two things touching, or it can mean a touching of the lips, right? But it seems impossible to me that between the time of the Anglo-Saxons and the time of the Tudors, that no one has put ing on the end of the verb kiss. I mean, it just must have happened.
Right. We can't hear the way people were conversing necessarily. So all of this could have come up colloquially.
And one of the things that people love about him so much is that he's able to speak to them, right? You know, the common people that are going to see him. And presumably one of the reasons why they feel like he's accessible to them is that he is using the sorts of words that they are using. It just can't be that you go to see a play where you can't understand a load of the words because they're new. And you come away going, that was brilliant. Or maybe, I don't know. Maybe you do.
The notion that Shakespeare is like high-minded and academic is a modern one, right?
Yeah.
Not necessarily, like, certainly artistic, certainly culturally important, but like your average person in the mosh pit was having a great time right along the kings and queens, you know?
We haven't really touched on the brilliance of Shakespeare. We should... Well, I should say anyway, I expect you agree. He is brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
You know, his plays are brilliant. The stories, though often they are, you know, adaptations of existing stories, they still manage to speak to everyday situations. This is why we have so many idioms. The words thing, you know, that 1700 number is actually conservative compared with early calculations of how many words he contributed to the English language.
Since then, many manuscripts from like pre-Shakespeare eras have been dug up, and we have found earlier instances of words that he used, which is why a lot of this has been pared down.
Well, it's something that's really good to read when considering this is a work by a guy called Harold Bailey, who wrote a book in 1906 in which he actually had got hold of early volumes of something known as the New English Dictionary, which we now call the Oxford English Dictionary. And what he did was he took the sections that he'd got and he counted up the citations from Shakespeare, the earliest, actually not just Shakespeare. What he did was he looked at all of the earliest citations for each word because they were including them in this magical new dictionary that they were creating. He then counted how many there were for each writer and he extrapolated that to what he thought the entire volume would contain. He reckoned that he'd got about 1% of it, and from that he extrapolated it. And from that, he concluded that Francis Bacon gave us 1,850 words. Graham Greene gave us 800. Christopher Marlowe gave us 525 words. Sir Thomas Browne gave us 2,850. And William Shakespeare gave us no fewer than 9,450 new words.
That is a hell of a way to estimate right there.
It's not dodgy maths. I'm sure the people that were creating the dictionary would have said to him, yeah, but I mean, there's no way that those early citations are going to be the actual earliest usages. They're just the text we've got to hand at the moment.
It's not
we
very
expect
empirical.
Over the next century.
Right.
Or to be precise, the next 119 years, that they'll have come up with a few more citations. Indeed, they have. And that's why that number in the Oxford English Dictionary will be much lower than 9,000.
Is this how estimation worked before control find?
Indeed, yeah. That's what happens when you get authors to do calculations. Any other lovely words that he can... So he did coin denote and devote, I think, and he is credited for being the first to import the word hostile from French, which I like, and bandit as well, which got from Italian, bandetto.
Yes, that one's cool.
He uses the word gloomy for the first time. He takes that noun gloom and turns it into an adjective gloomy, which is a nice one.
Some sources attribute that to like having pre-existed in Scottish and variations of English.
Well, it does sound rather Scottish, doesn't it?
Right.
Yeah. One can imagine. Again, we should caveat every single time we say coin a word with or is the first to write it down, you know?
I think it's perfectly fair to say that he coined, or at least his works are the first recorded instance of, swagger, even though the Middle English verb swag already meant to sway.
And, you know, all sorts of prefixes added and taken away, as you've talked about, like countless. There are countless examples, and countless is one of them.
It's also like poetic adaptations of things. Like the word harrow existed pre-Shakespeare. It was a word for a multi-toothed, I mean, it still is a word for a multi-toothed farm implement that you drag over soil to till it. And in Hamlet, his ghostly father prefaces his tale of foul and most unnatural murder by saying, "I would a tale unfold whose lightest word would harrow up thy soul." So like, that's a very nice physical image. So now when we say harrowing, we are referencing essentially that same concept of your soul being clawed at by this great machine. Part.
That's a nice one, that, yeah, where he uses the word figuratively for the first time, I suppose. Coinage is another one of those, actually. He's the first person to use coinage to not refer to a coin, which I like.
And then also like squishing words together to make like compounds, like lackluster is first recorded in As You Like It. In its first few instances, it describes eyes like lackluster due to weariness or stress or unintelligence. But like lack and luster already existed.
I honestly have genuinely never heard the word lackluster as lacking luster.
Really?
But that is what it means.
Yeah.
Why is that such a revelation to me? Rob, just think sometimes.
No, that's lovely. You think of it as a whole concept. That's like the, I think I mentioned this before, but the one that made me do that was the word wardrobe. I didn't think about the fact that it's a wardrobe, a thing that wards or protects your robes.
Yeah, it's the same as, this is the painstaking all
right.
over again.
Exactly,
same painstaking.
Thing.
Yeah, it's another one of those.
But he also made a lot of compounds with the word lack, like lack love, lack beard, and lack brain. So that was like a recurring trope.
Insults, Jess.
Ooh, we can definitely do that.
Let's talk about Shakespearean insults.
Mm-hmm, they're so good.
I imagine that you've got these mostly off the top of your head, stored in the top of your head, that's for sure. Shakespearean insults, famously cutting.
My favorite by far isn't like, it's not a new coinage by any means, but it's, "Thou hast no more brain than I have in mine elbows," from Troilus and Cressida.
Cutting.
But no, his plays boast an extensive, iconic, and often wildly entertaining collection of insults. A lot of the more famous, like horrible ones, are all like just Falstaff going off on someone, which happens regularly in the history plays.
Yeah, we did talk about these when we did our episode about insults, which is well worth a listen or a watch, by the way.
Some that I think have some interesting origins or things like that you might not immediately understand right away is a bolting hutch of beastliness, which a bolting hutch is, maybe someone knows this already, maybe I'm just unaware, but it is a bin for sifting flour from bran, essentially. So a bolting hutch is something that like collects the beastliness. You can also be, according to Falstaff, a swollen parcel of dropsies. Dropsies, which people probably know this, is an older informal term for like a swelling of bodily fluids.
Yeah, lovely.
You can also be a huge bombard of sack, which a bombard is much like a bombarding, is a medieval cannon used to hurl large stones at people.
A huge bombard of sack.
You could also be a stuffed cloak bag of guts, though that one's not very surprising.
These are beautiful.
Or a trunk of humors, which I could just imagine like a trunk like sloshing with bodily humors.
Oh, that's really grim.
A few of my other favorites are crusty batch of nature, ragged wart, dissembling harlot, bloody body villain, hateful withered hag, sanguine coward, huge hill of flesh.
There are so many of them. And the thing is, these are generally sort of delivered in a volley.
Oh, always. We've talked before in our insult episode about the sport of flighting, which was like basically your original rap battle and dramatically predates Shakespeare. So hurling a huge lump of insults in poetic form is a noble and storied tradition.
Should we talk about some of the idioms, etc., that come from Shakespeare? Because we're using them all the time without even realizing it.
I would say my favorite is "one fell swoop," which is first in Macbeth. The fell here is the same fell that we see in fell beast. It means cruel, vicious, or fierce. It's related to the word felon, not related to the past tense of the word fall, though there may have been some like cross-meaning pollination, folk etymology overlap due to the idea of like felling a tree, which is related to the past tense of fall.
And also in this particular instance, we're talking about the swooping of a bird.
Yes, a swoop
is
in particular.
A little like the action of falling, yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is one of those that often gets egg-corned into one foul swoop or something similar because it sounds a bit unusual. But when you read it in the context that it is intended, which is, you know, in Macbeth, I think, where they're talking about the murder of an entire family in one fell swoop, as if they were just poor little mice or poor little chicks or something that have been brutally murdered in one go. Then you start to understand the phrase and you go, ah, okay, yeah, I'm going to start using that.
I didn't realize that it was a regular egg corn until one of my TikTok followers, or not, somebody tagged me in a TikTok video about somebody asking whether it was one fell swoop or one foul swoop. I didn't know that one foul swoop was a thing that was commonly misunderstood, but I can understand why, because, you know, murder most foul comes up quite a lot in these plays.
Yeah, we talk a lot about egg corns and give examples of them that I've never really come across, but one foul swoop I actually have come across, and I've heard it on the television.
Oh, no
kidding.
People
who should know better, mm-hmm. using one foul swoop. Yeah.
I suppose having encountered fell beasts before, I was pre-prepared for the...
That's it. Yeah, your pre-existing...
the fellness of the swoop.
Your beast experience meant you're already well aware of it. Were you well aware of wild geese before? Wild goose chase. Yeah, that's one of his from Romeo and Juliet. To break the ice is another one.
Mm-hmm. Let it slide.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds so modern.
He didn't use exactly the, like, let it slide. He said, let the world slide in Taming of the Shrew. And it means, like, let it take its own course, of course.
And to come full circle as well sounds almost bureaucratic.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost jargon, but it's King Lear.
Into Thin Air is another one. That's from The Tempest. These, our actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air.
The Tempest also has foul play in it as well. Tempest is an interesting one because it's a genuine Shakespeare creation, that story. I mean, it might have been influenced by one or two other things, but that's really Shakespeare having a go at writing his own tale from start to finish. You know, it's not one that's based on something else, which I think makes it an interesting one.
I like the adaptations of it a lot too. It's good. Is The Tempest your favorite Shakespearean play?
Midsummer Night's Dream is obviously...
It's just so fun and all purpose. Like, that one's hilarious no matter how old it gets, and it's horny and it's fun and it's zany. It's like a modern day sitcom.
Twelfth Night is also very funny.
Oh, I love that one. I think that's probably my favorite.
Malvolio strutting around making a complete fool of himself.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just great stuff in so many of them. Titus Andronicus gave me nightmares.
Oh God, that play is terrifying. I have like the first time I read it, I like one of the scenes in particular, I got so stressed out that I had to stop reading it. It's very disturbing.
Is that the one that involves baking people into pies by any chance?
It's the thing that the dudes do in order to warrant being baked into pies. The way they like torture this person who ends up living the rest of the play. It's terrible. Excuse me.
It is hard to imagine that being written by the same person as You Like It, the Comedy of Errors, whatever.
It's obscenely bloody and I think the most disturbing of the plays. Like the fact that Macbeth is considered worse. I mean, maybe it has more a higher kill count, but like there are some horrible and depraved and horrifying things that happen in Titus Andronicus on stage too.
Let's talk about the authorship question, because we're going to upset people here, whatever our take is.
I don't know. I feel like my take is very bland.
So do you think Shakespeare wrote all of his plays?
I think that he was a collaborative artist. I mean, just see what it took to put together his onstage productions. Like, that takes a whole lot of people. And I can't imagine that he was sitting in a room alone penning all of these by himself. But I do think it is right to credit him as the author of these works.
I agree with you. I think he did write them all. And I think the idea that there's someone else, or is there some dark collaboration going on that happened? They happen to have just picked the name of this son of a glove maker in Stratford as their pseudonym. Well, I imagine choosing a pseudonym of a person who actually exists, or just an actor who is undoubtedly, you know, prolific performing for King and Queen. I just don't buy it. I mean, we should talk through though the arguments for and against and let people make their own decisions. I mean, I talked about one of the big arguments for there, and it's just that contemporaries talk about him. He was super, super famous in his day. But also we talked about how Titus Andronicus, it seems hard that it could be written by the same person as some of his other plays, but there is consistency, remarkable consistency.
Oh yeah.
In the styles of the writings of his plays and the ways in which he coins words as well that make it seem very unlikely that they're written by different people, you know, like a different set of people, assuming that they weren't all written by one other person.
This is totally my own impression, but like, for example, the witch scenes in Macbeth have sort of a different style and rhythm, and that's entirely possible that it's the same author just writing in a different style because it's a crazy witch scene. But I could also see, like, I don't know, Marlowe wrote that part or something like that, you know?
Yeah, you were a little more anti-Stratfordian than I was expecting you to be, Jess.
What do you mean?
Because you think he didn't write some of the stuff that people say he wrote.
Oh, I don't know necessarily. You are projecting a degree of firmness to me that I do not have. I just know what the writing process looks like. Having writing buddies and writing groups is a perfectly common and normal thing. So someone having penned a certain passage or line or having inspired one makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, and it certainly was in Elizabethan theatre as well, the collaborative process. Absolutely.
How much improvisation could have led to alterations in scripts that we have, for example?
But the arguments against him having written this stuff, I mean, to my mind, it's a largely sort of classist thing, and it didn't really emerge as an idea much until the mid-1800s, when he started to be really revered. And then people started to say, well, come on, how could this guy, I already mentioned, you know, he's the son of a glove maker. His dad, John, is quite the character, by the way, sort of like a local politician, but also a notorious local wheeler dealer as well. His parents are both illiterate. You know, they sign their names with just a mark. So how can this man have, you know, the greatest commander of our language of all time have grown up in an illiterate household? Why is there no evidence of his name in school records? Well, one of the reasons for that is there's no evidence of the name of any kids in school records. They're just missing
from the local classroom.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, that's one of the arguments there. These are the reasons that people believe that he can't possibly have done it. And the reason I say I think is a bit classist is that the people that are generally put across as probably having done the work are people who are much more educated than him, who, you know, went to Oxford or Cambridge, the likes of Francis Bacon, Edward de Vere, Christopher Marlowe, William Stanley, 6th Earl of Derby, from where I am speaking to you right now. Yeah, all Oxbridge educated. We're going to get complaints, Jess.
People can complain all they like. I'm not, I take no firm stance on this. And like, if somebody wants to fight me about it, they are welcome to, and they will find me not up in arms.
We'll never know, will we? That's the thing.
Without his original handwriting on a piece of paper, there's not firm evidence one way or another, as far as I'm concerned.
So the authorship question is not a foregone conclusion. Haha, another Shakespeare phrase there. So have we come full circle on Shakespeare, Jess?
I think we could hobnob a little bit about obscure and interesting Shakespearean words that you can work into your everyday speech. By the way, hobnob is also another Shakespeare original, though it meant something a little bit different back then. Rather than like rubbing elbows, it was you can take it or leave it, hob or like hit or miss. But anyway, well, let's talk about more obscure ones because we all know what hobnob means.
Actually, do you know what a hobnob really means?
What does it really mean?
The biscuit. The best biscuit.
What? Oh, yes. I have had hobnobs, but only like...
You had a chocolate
recently.
Hobnob?
Yes, I have. I haven't had the chocolate one. I've had the regular one.
Well, I will be taking some back with me when I fly back to Berlin.
Anyway, rare and interesting words in Shakespeare. A few like longer, more elaborate ones that you might not use in your everyday discussions would be honorific abilitudinitatibus, which is from Love's Labour's Lost.
I recognize that tatibus thing as being something that people stick on the end of words to make them sound Latin and long.
It was also like an actual Latin word. It's one of those like anti-disestablishmentarianism ones where it has like a unique and specific usage, but then was like hauled into Love's Labour's Lost for cheeky purposes. But it means the state of being able to achieve honors, essentially.
Nice.
There's that. I have seen this word elsewhere. So this is not like, I don't think this is that obscure by any means, but I do like the usage from the Merry Wives of Windsor of the word anthropophaginian. Do you know what that means?
Wait, so say it to me again and I'm going to try and guess it.
Anthropophaginian.
So anthropo means like a person, right? Mm-hmm. And we've discussed phage as being like something that eats something. Am I close?
Yes, it's a cannibal.
Brilliant. Anthropophaginian.
Anthropophagy is the version that I have seen more recently than Shakespeare, but in Act 4, Scene 5, you can go and check out the humorous usage of that term.
Oh, brilliant. So another word for a cannibal is an anthropophage.
Mm-hmm. A couple of less complicated ones would be sluggardized. You could probably use that one functionally. It means to be made into an idler, basically, to be made lazy, so to speak.
Yeah, he also uses the term sluggabed to mean a lazy person, which I like.
I do like this quote. It's from Two Gentlemen of Verona, which I don't think we mentioned yet. I rather would entreat thy company to see the wonders of the world abroad than living dully sluggardized at home, which I think is a relatable sentiment.
Who doesn't feel sluggardized?
If your face is covered in like something warm in the winter, you are mobbled, which is found in Hamlet. Though I think in that case, he was referring to a veil rather than something that is fully muffled. Fleshment is the excitement associated with a successful beginning, which sounds terrible to me.
It definitely just sounds like whatever it is that zombies do.
Yeah, right. But no, it's like being fleshed, the act of being fleshed out, essentially. Another one, this is a good one that you could probably use. It reminds me of the word turmoil and is probably, at least there may be some sense crossover there, but a garboil is a trouble or a disturbance or a commotion. It's from Middle French and it means a confused mess, but it's probably ultimately from Italian.
So there we have a whole Shakespearean plethora of words to try and use.
Indeed.
Over the next week.
And I think that's all I have for the moment. I think we can go on and on. There are wonderful whirligigs and there are notes of admiration throughout Shakespeare that we have not addressed. But I think we could probably perhaps revisit this again in the future.
I think we can probably revisit the most influential figure in the entirety.
Surely not.
I would say he might be the most significant cultural figure ever. And I don't just mean in terms of the English language. I just mean ever, because if you bear in mind like the dominance of English around the world and his influence upon that, it's hard to think of an individual who has had a bigger impact on the way that so many people do that cultural thing that is speak.
I would agree with that. I'd say the only person, people I can think of otherwise are like religious figures.
Well, this has been fascinating, Jess. Thank you so much.
It's been lovely. May you enjoy your next Shakespearean excursion a little more informed.
And we will wait with bated breath until we see you next. Take care.